I'm J.A. Adande, and it's time for three stories you should know. U.S. Olympic athletes are considering forming a union, and that's where we're going to start this week. I'm joined by The Wall Street Journal's Rachel Bachman and by Lindsay Gibbs of Think Progress. Welcome back to both of you.
Great to be here, J.A.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Rachel, what's going on?
Well, Jay, U.S. Olympic athletes for years have been frustrated at what they see as their lack of power in decision-making at the U.S. Olympic Committee, and the Larry Nassar sexual abuse scandal in gymnastics might have been their last straw. The USOC's Athletics Advisory Council, made up of athletes elected by others in their sport, said last weekend they're considered forming a union. They really signaled they're serious about this by who they invited as an advisor, Don Fair, the former MLB Players Association executive director.
Dun, dun, dun.
Exactly. I mean, they mean business, right? And he's not formally retained by them, but he was there to answer questions and I think signaled the seriousness of this consideration.
I'm all for unions. I think they absolutely need more power. Logistically, I think I have a hard time picturing exactly how this works, considering the Olympic movement is, of course, about so much more than just the athletes that make it to the Olympics. And there's so many sports, but just because it's hard doesn't mean it shouldn't be done and they shouldn't take steps towards getting more power. And if they can figure out a way to actually unionize, I think that could be a whole new world for Olympic athletes.
As you say, the logistics sounds so daunting, right?
Yeah.
When you've got so many different sports, so many different athletes, different seasons, different cycles, how do you get everybody coordinated? And I had the thought that initially you don't want to see these type of things in Olympics, right? That's one thing we like about them. You don't have lockouts or strikes. But we have seen in the past, if you're old enough to remember, boycotts. We've seen, for example, the United States stay home and convince some allies to do the same in 1980 to protest Russia's invasion of Afghanistan. The Eastern Bloc, led by the then Soviet Union, returned the favor in 1984. So if the decisions can be made for the athletes, and why can't the athletes have some agency in their decisions and do what's in their best interest, even if that means some type of labor shutdown when it comes to the Olympics, Rachel?
I think so. And I think you guys make good points about the difficulty they might have in organizing what we understand as a union. But I do think they might end up with some sort of professional representation outside of what they have now. You know, the advisory council has existed for a long time, but, you know, they're all volunteers. They're all athletes. So they're extremely busy. So I think they are realizing if they want to have a meaningful voice, they really need to try something else.
More litigation in sports. Lindsay, what do you have for us?
This past week, a bill was shut down in the South Dakota legislature that would have made sure that transgender youth could only participate in sports based on the gender on their birth certificate, not their gender identity. Activists had said this would essentially ban transgender kids from participating in youth sports. What was noteworthy about this was the words that were used to defend the existence of the bill, which came directly from Martina Navratilova. Of course, the LGBT or LGB champion of rights, tennis legend herself, she had written an op-ed in the Sunday Times saying that allowing transgender women in women's sports is cheating. To put the argument at its most basic, a man can decide to be female, take hormones, win everything in sight, and then go back and reverse his decision. Now, Martina said that this was only pertaining to elite athletes and that she did not mean this to be used on the grassroots level, but it's hard to see how she didn't see this coming.
I think first we do need to acknowledge that the world is changing faster than a lot of people are comfortable with, and I think that's why you see reactionary bills like this. But as we know, authority figures have banned people in the past from certain areas or pursuits. And in most cases, we know that's very wrong. And these are cautionary tales. You know, any ban or prohibition has to be backed with science, reason, not scare tactics. And, you know, also with the legislature, how about sending a signal to high school sports not to take things too seriously by taking on issues that really should stay at the local level with coaches or maybe the high school association? I think they just waded in where they shouldn't have.
And speaking of wading in where perhaps they shouldn't have, but to have Martina Navratilova, long considered a champion of gay and lesbian rights in sports and beyond, to have her words used in this situation, I think is surprising and certainly for so many people disappointing. But what it served to me is a reminder that it's hard to compact complicated issues into one convenient moniker. Just because someone such as Martina Navratilova can be such a great champion for the gay and lesbian cause, it doesn't automatically mean she's going to be a great champion for the transgender cause.
Absolutely. And I think the saddest thing is that she was just pushing false narratives. She's pushing this fear-mongering tactic. And it is disappointing, and I hope that she will listen and learn.
Moving over to college basketball, the idea of shutting it down has been in the news recently with regards to Zion Williamson. The Duke star recently suffered a knee injury. A lot of people thought he should just sit out the rest of the season and prepare himself for the NBA draft, and there was a lot of pushback to that. But I noticed that you don't have much of an argument whenever there is a suggestion or the actual forcing to take a redshirt season. You notice why you don't hear much argument? Because this is done to protect the school, right? They get more return on investment. They get another year of eligibility. Why aren't we having more conversations about redshirting itself if people are so put off by the notion of an athlete shutting it down?
One reason we're not having more conversations is because I think at the very highest levels of college sports, redshirting is really on the wane. College football coaches, for instance, many of them are on the three-year plan. They assume that players will not stay 1 minute longer than the three-year minimum they have to before they enter the NFL draft. And so they want to have guys on a schedule to maybe even have a chance to graduate in 3 years because they know they're not going to get recruits if they're going to force them to redshirt in many cases. And I think the same is true in college basketball. You know, the very best players, coaches just accept they're not going to stay longer than a year. And so no college basketball coach in his right mind would force, you know, Zion Williamson to redshirt because he's basically shooting himself in the foot and not benefiting from his services for that year.
You know, you see it similarly used to deal with transfers, right? I see in the women's basketball game all the time, forced to sit out for a year because you transfer schools and they want to discourage these students from transferring. And you're right, it's all about what's in the best interest of the schools. It's probably time to rethink the whole system. Beyond time, actually, I would say.
One idea that might help, but was actually suggested by the athletic director at Florida, who just mused on Twitter one day, what about adding a fifth year of eligibility? Give everyone, well, in particular, high-achieving academic prep athletes, you know, if they do well academically, then as they enter college, they would be granted a fifth year of eligibility potential. So there you have the academic incentive that they say they want, right, for these student athletes. And also that would help mitigate this redshirting issue, right? You wouldn't have to worry about losing 25% of your eligibility if you redshirt a year because you would have that fifth year waiting for you if you'd done well enough in school. I'd like to thank my guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know. It's been Lindsay Gibbs of Think Progress, in addition to The Wall Street Journal's Rachel Bachman. Thank you, Lindsay, and thank you, Rachel.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Jay.